morning is case number 58649, Lapas versus District Court. Mr. Lapas. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Leapas.
Mr. Leapas.
May it please the court, my name is Mark T. Leapas, counsel for petitioner Theodore L. Leapas. And at this time, I would like to request or reserve 5 minutes time for rebuttal.
Certainly.
This matter arises out of my status as the son of the parties. And the court below entered an order of disqualification of counsel on the grounds of the apparent grounds of concurrent conflict of interest and lawyer as a witness. I will now address each in turn. The first is concurrent conflict of interest. That is Nevada Rule of Professional Conduct, Rule 1.7. And that rule provides in pertinent part that a concurrent conflict of interest exists if there is a significant risk that the representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by a personal interest of the lawyer. Of course, that rule has an exception, and the exception provides that notwithstanding the existence of a concurrent conflict of interest, the representation may proceed if, and here I request the court's permission to read briefly, one, the lawyer reasonably believes that the lawyer will be able to provide competent and diligent representation to each affected client. Two, the representation is not prohibited by law. Three, the representation does not involve the assertion of a claim by one client against another client represented by the lawyer in the same litigation or other proceeding before a tribunal. And four, each affected client gives informed consent, confirmed in writing. Throughout these proceedings, the petitioner and I have been forthright in recognizing that it could be asserted arguably that counsel has a concurrent conflict of interest and that I am the son of the petitioners. But in reality, we feel that there is not necessarily a conflict because there is not necessarily a significant risk that the representation will be limited as a result. And that is because the real party in interest has counsel, experienced counsel of her own. In my case, I will be committed to representing the petitioner and he would have no counsel otherwise if I did not represent him, and we do not believe that there is an actual conflict. Having said that, out of an abundance of caution and to ensure compliance with all potentially applicable standards, ethical standards, the petitioner was advised of that possibility, and as a result, he did execute a conflict waiver form recognizing the relation. The district court in its order appears to hold that there is necessarily a conflict and that it was not convinced that I could provide competent and diligent representation to the petitioner. The court's order, however, contains no findings to support that conclusion. In fact, I believe that the record shows the opposite. In fact, that there is no proof in the record of a significant risk of a conflict except in the fact that I am the son of the parties, and also that the record provides no proof that I could not provide, that I could not provide competent and diligent representation at all times. I believe that the record confirms my reasonable belief that I could provide competent and diligent representation to the petitioner.
Let me ask, why do you want to represent your father?
Because I wanted to represent him because, first of all, he cannot afford to hire counsel of his own. He does not understand the rules and procedures of the family law court. And because of his history with the real party in interest, he has concerns that she may behave herself or through her counsel, behave delusionally, or make accusations against him that he would not be able to effectively defend against. And so he does have genuine concerns about proceeding on his own without a counsel, and he has concerns about being subject to orders that he could not understand or even comply with, and he believes that with the counsel, he could have a higher likelihood of a better result. He does not want to prolong the activities of the case below. He is hopeful of getting it resolved as soon as he can. And as I said, I think that the real issue here is whether or not my belief is reasonable that I could provide competent and diligent representation.
Do you still have a relationship with your mother where you see her and talk to her?
She does not live in the state anymore, so far as I know. I do continue to have a due regard to her. We are not separated in that sense.
Because you run into a problem if you talk to her, counsel may object to that. Because it's even though it's your mother, you're litigating against her.
I have not spoken to her since she left about a year and a half ago. And that's partly, I think, primarily because of these proceedings. And I do, like I said, I do continue to have a due regard for her. I do not have, and petitioner, neither myself nor petitioner, has any ill will toward her. We just have concerns about her mental state and how it could play out in the case below, and that's why petitioner has special concerns about proceeding on its own without counsel. And in view of, as I said before, I think that the record does show that my belief is reasonable, that it could provide competent and diligent representation, and we believe that the court's ruling in this regard is arbitrary and completely unfounded. The second apparent ground that the court used for disqualification was lawyer as a witness. And that rule provides...
Doesn't DiMartino just eliminate that as a basis for this?
I believe so, Your Honor. I think that is a really truly a non-issue. I did want to address it in case the court wanted me to, but if the courts have a mind that DiMartino eliminated that as an issue, that is our position as well. So if the court is of that mind, I can go forward. Would the court prefer that I go forward to the next topic?
I'd like to hear something about DiMartino. Go ahead.
You would? Okay.
Please.
NRPC 3.7 provides that a lawyer shall not act as an advocate at a trial in which the lawyer is likely to be a necessary witness. That rule does have a hardship exception, and it provides that an exception where the disqualification would work a hardship on the client. And as Your Honor mentioned, the court addressed this rule in the DiMartino case, and it held that it construed the rule by its terms, held that the rule does not apply unless there is a trial. It applies at a trial. And in this case, there was the trial hasn't even been set yet. We were at a settlement conference, and the court applied the rule. And the court also failed to address the hardship exception and balance the interests. And the court is also required under the hardship exception to balance the interest and consider whether a case may not go to trial, whether other evidence may be available in place of the attorney's testimony, and whether the attorney's client may prefer not to have him testify. And as I mentioned before, the court's order in this regard, on this particular issue, is truly premature. I've never been designated a witness at trial by anybody. I've been designated a person with knowledge. And I do not anticipate being called by the petitioner to testify at any trial on this matter. And and then also, there are no findings in regard to the hardship extension and exception in any event. I think, as the court suggested already, I mean, this is truly a non-issue, and I address it at the court's request. But we believe that it's a non-issue. In the petitioner's view, the only just result is for the writ to issue. I mean, the petitioner, as I alluded to before, the petitioner is not an attorney. He does not understand the policies and procedures of the family court. He does not have the funds to hire his own attorney, and especially for a community that is probably worth less than what any attorney would charge for a retainer. And he has concerns about the real party and interest history of hostile and delusional behavior toward him, and how that would play out in any case below, and what kind of a result he may be subject to without an attorney. And he does, however, seek a prompt settlement of the matter below. He will defend if necessary, but that is not preferred in his part. He does seek a prompt settlement. But myself and petitioner bear no ill will toward the real party in interest, as we mentioned before. My role is simply to protect the petitioner, and the real party in interest is represented by our own experienced counsel. So in conclusion, in petitioner's view under the Brown versus District Court case, in his view, there is no reasonable possibility that a specifically identifiable impropriety did in fact occur. And in his view, the social interest and the equities weigh in favor of counsel's continued representation of the petitioner in the matter below. And my status as the son of the parties should not and is not grounds alone for disqualification by itself. And the real party in interest, in any event, has shown no prejudice to herself. And on all these bases, the court's order is an abuse of discretion, and the petition should be granted and the writ issued. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. King.
May it please the court, my name is Jonathan King. I represent Marie Weapas. She cannot be here today. She lives now in Wisconsin. I'd like to start off by pointing out a couple of things I think are important. Mr. Weapas represented himself for about 5 months before his son substituted in. I can assure you that every pleading before and every pleading since, even when he was in pro per, was ghostwritten by his son. Even correspondence from the father comes in envelopes with the return address of the son. One of the things that I have a real problem with, I would have liked to have jumped up and objected, but I'm not real clear on whether I can do that. I know I can only speak from this podium. But back on June 15, 2011, the district court said Mark Weapas is disqualified. Yet his name's on the petition. He just argued in front of you. He's never sought and he's never obtained any order allowing him to do so. There's been no stay of the district court's decision. I think that the very act of filing this petition and talking to you shows that he needs to not be the attorney for his father. Now, if we look at the five or six case law decisions, we keep talking about the same thing, that unless the petitioner can show an abuse of discretion, and he is not, that the district court decision is going to stand. Second, the presumption that any doubt should be resolved in favor of disqualification. And I appreciate the question about DiMartino, but remember, that still left open the issue regarding whether that attorney would have been prevented at the trial stage. We didn't even object to the son acting at the settlement conference stage. The judge decided to disqualify at that point. This really isn't a case that I think there was much likelihood that there would be a disqualification.
So do you concede that for purposes of all pretrial proceedings in this matter, the prohibition against acting as a lawyer in a matter in which you're going to be called as a witness at trial is not an appropriate grounds for disqualification?
Maybe not in those words, but I would say the door is open for that. DiMartino seems to stand for that proposition.
Okay, then let's move to the issue of conflict of interest and how Marie Leapis has standing to assert an impermissible disqualifying conflict of interest exists in this case. She has to do that to support the district court's order of disqualification. And I have concerns with that finding.
Well, I think the appearance of impropriety has to be considered at the same time.
The appearance of impropriety was in Canon 9 of the Rules of Professional Conduct, the old Code of Professional Conduct. When Nevada adopted the Rules of Professional Conduct, the ABA model rules do not carry that standard forward in the attorney disqualification arena. So that is a dead letter, in my estimation. And I was concerned that you're citing ABA Canon 9 when both the ABA and Nevada have jettisoned that standard. So you have to make a conflict of interest argument. You have to identify a conflict that your client is able to assert disqualifies Mr. Leapis.
Well, I would just go back to my brief. The repeated inferences appealing to sympathy, passion, and prejudice, the issues that Mark Weapas has already told you that they're going to get into in this trial, his divided loyalty where he claims to still love his mother, and yet he wants to assert all these positions, which would seem to show exactly the opposite.
But does she have standing, legally, does she have standing to assert those conflicts? It's an issue as to him and his client. You're identifying conflicts that might disable him at his client's instance, but there's been full disclosure and consent, and you have to process this under Rule 17.
Well, I guess we don't know it until we hear it. I mean, we don't know it until we actually get to trial, and the court has to make some sort of predictions as to what exactly is going to come out. Perhaps he's not going to appear and testify as a witness. We don't know that. But he's at least laid out the areas that apparently he's going to attempt to attack credibility of the wife in this case.
Why can't he? He doesn't represent her. He has never represented her. What in 1.7 precludes Mr. Liapis, Mark Liapis, from engaging in that type of cross-examination, for example?
I would go back to that balancing of prejudices that was first announced in Cronin and then followed in all the other cases. And I hate to get so vague in general as to talk about what we've always talked about in Nevada for years, something we would describe briefly as sort of the smell test, and the idea that a child of the same mother and same father could, in a hotly contested divorce case, represent one spouse against the other is just distasteful.
That might
I know that's not directly responsive, but that's the best I can say.
It might be distasteful on familial grounds, but the question posed by the rule, or required by the rule, is a demonstration of some either confidential relationship between Mark and his mother, or confidential communication by his mother to him, that at least forms some basis under the rule for assertion of a conflict that she can maintain. In the absence of that, he's never represented her as counsel. And there's been no showing, at least in this record that I know of, that she has divulged confidences to him that he would appropriate in some respect.
There is nothing in the record, Your Honor.
I appreciate your concern that, you know, his son may have some unique knowledge about his parents, but at least at this stage, there isn't any showing that there's been a confidence, as I understand it, that the two of them have shared.
I would give you a hypothetical. You were my father, I am cross-examining you. Or, you are not my father, and I am cross-examining you. There is, as an independent attorney, there's probably nothing that I could do to get your goat. But if I was your son, I would know what buttons to push, and I would know what makes you mad, or what
you probably pushed
you
many of them in the years past.
you know, it's something that we just need to not have. I'm not asking you to announce some sort of rule that says that in every case, every child cannot represent a parent. I mean, over the years, for one reason or another, we represent relatives all the time, but father versus mother, not stepfather versus mother, but mother versus father, I think that that's just something that here you don't have to make the ruling you're being asked to make. We can just look back to the no showing of abuse of discretion, doubt should be resolved in favor of disqualification, and when we balance the prejudices, this is a garden variety divorce case. These people are elderly. My client's 68, I think. The husband is older. There's
Mr.
an
King,
issue.
Mr. King, I'm sorry for interrupting you. I didn't mean to do that.
No.
Have financial disclosures been filed in the case?
Well, in fact, I even objected. He's attached financial disclosures in the record.
Yeah.
So you have those.
I just wondered if those had been filed. I know that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. There, I think, are.
No, I don't mean filed here. I mean filed in the district court.
Yes, they're filed in both. I think there's new circumstances. I think that the husband is now not working, so that the information is not current, but I don't know that it would have any effect on your ultimate decision. Yeah. I think I've used up my time, so.
No, you have 5 minutes and 15 seconds left.
Oh, I do? Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. The only other thing I really wanted to comment on, I think...
Maybe I could ask this question of you to see if this fits within 1.7A2. The rule says that a concurrent conflict of interest exists if, 2, there is a significant risk that the representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibilities to another client, a former client, and these are the operative words, or a third person, or by a personal interest of the lawyer. Would you argue that a third person, or by a personal interest of the lawyer, creates the relationship between child and mother?
I'd like to, but I honestly don't think I can. I think that's referring to litigation involvement, that there's a child involved in the past. I really don't think it does. Counsel made a comment in his concluding remarks about his still having due regard for his mother, yet he told you in answer to questions that he hasn't talked to her in more than a year and a half, not because of some concern that there would be some sort of improper contact because of this litigation, but really because this very existence of this dynamic has created a situation where son and mother are no longer talking. It's a close case, but the district court heard the parties, made its decision, and I really don't think you should overturn it.
Did you actually initiate the request for disqualification, or did the district judge?
This is how it came up. We're in a settlement conference, so the record is not on. I raise the disqualification issue, although my opponent says the opposite. He's mistaken. We then have a lengthy discussion, and I make the comments about let's proceed and go ahead and do the settlement conference. We don't need to stop now, but he was concerned. And then he requested briefing, and if I remember correctly, there may have even been a motion for reconsideration in this case. But no, I raised the issue because my client objected to her son representing her husband.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King. Ms. Lapis, you have some time left for rebuttal if you'd like to speak some more.
Your Honors, let me take a few minutes to reply to some of the comments made by...
Before you do, I would like to hear your response to Justice Hardesty's question, reading from the rule about obligations to third parties and whether that could apply to this situation.
I think, in my view... I don't think that there is a significant risk of the representation being limited in any material way, and in regard to that portion, we did recognize that this is a unique situation and that someone may raise a legal concern in that regard. That's why the petitioner signed a conflict waiver.
But, so, Mr. Miapas, are you conceding that the language in A2 would extend to a child-mother relationship, but the significant risk portion of that rule is overcome by the waiver by your client?
No, Your Honor, I mean, I don't think so. I think that refers more toward financial type of situations, I think, as Real Party and Interest Council has mentioned. I think that's probably the intention of that language, and that's really not the situation here. And we do want to emphasize, of course, that there has been no actual finding of a significant risk of
The language personal interest is referring to financial interest?
Well, I think so. I think that that's what I think that's what the drafters of the rules had concerns about lawyers overreaching in terms of financial matters. I think that's by and large where the rules are going to. I think even if the court sees it broader than that, we feel that there's been no evidence presented in the record that would tend to suggest that I'm not reasonable in my belief that there's no significant risk or that I could provide competent and diligent representation. The approach that we took is we wanted to cover every possible base here. We didn't want to be appearing to ignore any kind of an ethical standard. But I do tend to think that that's, as counsel states, that that's more of a financial type of an issue. And like I said, even if it's not, I think there has to be a factual basis for a disqualification, no matter how it's construed. In this case, I don't think there's been any kind of a factual basis that's been shown by the real party in interest, other than the fact that I am her son. But like I said, my response to that is that I believe that the petitioner needs my protection because he's unable to afford an attorney of his own, and he has concerns about her mental history toward him, and he doesn't feel comfortable proceeding in the case below without a counsel of some sort. And so that's the approach that we took. So in summary, I tend to think that does refer more toward a financial interest. I think that the rules are geared more that way, but no matter how it's construed, I do think that there has to be some sort of a specific factual basis for disqualification. It can't be just a party's status. I mean, as counsel conceded, or maybe one of the justices stated, attorneys every so often do represent family members. So it's not something that should be an automatic ground for disqualification.
But his point is not normally against other family members.
Yes, but also what's unique about this situation, too, is that, like I said, the other family member is represented by our own counsel. And in this situation, the petitioner, he has genuine concerns about her history against him. He has genuine concerns about whether he could have any kind of a defense in the court below without an attorney. And he can't afford to pay his own attorney. So he does have significant equities and weighing in his favor, and it would unfairly prejudice him not to have an attorney. Whereas, on the other hand, the real party in interest has really shown no prejudice against herself, where she's just simply constantly pounding on the table saying, he's my son, he's my son. And I frankly don't think that's enough. I think that she has to show more, no matter how that rule is construed. And she hasn't shown any more than that. And I think that the prejudices to the petitioner, if he does not have counsel, could truly be severe. He wants my help, and as I've mentioned, he is making every attempt to seek a settlement of the action below, and he does not bear ill will toward the real party in interest. He just wants to put his best foot forward through his attorney, and that's the approach that he's taken throughout this matter, regardless of how the rules are construed. And a couple of things that I did want to mention was that, and as I think I should to add upon that, I think that this kind of a determination should be a case-by-case kind of a determination and not a broad general rule that applies to everyone. It should be based on the facts that support or don't support representation, and I think here the facts do support representation. The opposing party's prejudices are minimal. And if I may, there are a couple of things I still wanted to address in addition.
Unfortunately, you're out of time.
Okay, I will.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Thank you, Mr. King. This matter will stand submitted.